This is Mark Strassman, reporter for Utopia Media Medical News Network. We're very honored today to have as our guest Dr. Eric Jacobson, whose titles are going to take a few minutes to go through, but he's the director of the Center for Bioinformatics and Computational Biology at the National Institute of General Medical Sciences at the National Institutes of Health, and he's also the chair of the Biomedical Information Science and Technology Initiative Consortium within the National Institutes of Health. Welcome, Dr. Jacobson, to Utopia Media Medical News Network.
Well, thank you. It's good to talk with you again.
We're going to talk mainly today about the new Center for Quantitative Biology that's being set up at Princeton. But first, why don't we just talk a little bit about where you sit within all this. What do you do as director of the Center for Bioinformatics and Computational Biology, and what exactly is that that center?
This is an entity that's been in National Institute of General Medical Sciences for a few years, and it's been established to direct the extramural funding for applications that are very compute intensive, where the major point of the research is the computation as opposed to the wet lab.
Okay.
So we have divisions of cell biology and biophysics, we have a division of genetics and developmental biology, we have a division of physiology and pharmacology and biochemistry, but in all of that subject matter, if the particular grant application is one where the emphasis is computational rather than experimental, then that will come over to my center to be administered.
Okay, it's very interesting. I was thinking about that as you were talking, that in a book called Guile's Goat Boy, written in the late 60s, early 70s by John Barth, there's a statement, which is a book, in fact, the hero of whom is a half-goat, half-computer person, who was created by a genetic experiment. There's a character who says, all science is now library science. In a sense, what you're talking about and doing there is saying that all or most or a lot of biological science is now computer science or a mixture. Is that the case?
Well, yeah, and also, there's another side to that, which is that library science has become very much like computer science too.
Right.
So we see more and more that the content of what schools of library and information science do is very, very computer science-y. So as a matter of fact, all of the information rich disciplines have become, if not computer science, have become very, very computational.
And without getting too philosophical about it too fast, in fact, the DNA is in fact a library of nucleotides, and it's all information processing by sort of bioinformation processing is what genetics is in a large sense. And so using sort of silicon or electronic information processing to process our understanding of how the biological computers work is all very integratable, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, information is, if not the full reality of nature, it's how we interact with nature.
Right, and how nature interacts with itself.
At least in a scientific way, or how nature interacts with us, how we and nature interact with each other.
And according to Shakespeare, we are part of nature anyway. So.
Right.
As the chair of the Biomedical Information Science and Technology Initiative Consortium, you do the same thing with different people, or what exactly do you do in that role?
That's more of a coordinating role, although we are administering through that entity. The new National Centers for Biomedical Computing.
Oh, okay.
And we will announce the awardees for that competition later this month.
Now, how does that differ from the Center for Quantitative Biology?
The Center for Quantitative Biology is entirely administered by the within National Institute of General Medical Sciences.
Okay, and what is this other group or set of centers that you were talking about?
The other set of centers are National Centers for Biomedical Computing, And these are administered by a team that has representatives from multiple of the NIH institutes.
Okay, and what's the extent of what you're going to be announcing later this month, which hopefully we can get back to you and have you talk about after you announce it?
We will be announcing, NIH will be announcing, and that announcement will come out of the Office of the Director.
Right.
We'll be announcing the awardees for the first round competition of National Centers for Biomedical Computing. And these are envisaged to be the hubs of a network that we're building in, of extramural projects that'll build an excellent biomedical computing environment for the nation.
Extramural is a term of art that's very important, apparently, in your work. What does it mean, and how does it sort of specify what the relationship between NIH is and the other organizations that it's essentially seeding or coordinating or funding?
Yeah, extramural programs are ones that we fund to actually be implemented at universities or other kinds of research institutions around the country. So our share of that money, we take about 3.5 cents out of every dollar to create the programs, review the programs, do financial administration of the programs, and then 96.5 cents out of every extramural dollar goes out directly to universities or other research institutions to implement the extramural program.
Now, in terms of those intramural programs that are extramural programs that are implemented, does NIH set priorities or give assignments to these other organizations? Say, here, you work on cell membranes, and you work on nuclei, and you work on communications within the cell or something, or do they get the money and they go out and do what they want?
We put out the money in three forms. One form is grants, and grants are very much like what you've just described. In a grant, we have an application. The applicant says what they propose to do. We give them the money based on that description, but basically they function extremely independently.
Right.
Then there's a second kind of award that we make called a cooperative agreement. And in a cooperative agreement, we actually share throughout the implementation of the project the management of it. And
right.
So we would, for example, sit on an advisory council that the principal investigator and the senior investigators would meet with periodically, and we would express our views as to really the directions that they should take.
Right.
Then the third type of award is a contract. And a contract is really a fee for service. So in a contract, typically, one puts out a request for proposals that's extremely detailed, where you say exactly what you want the applicant to do and what you expect the product to be.
That would either be something procedural or develop a test of a certain kind, or would it also be something more substantive and say find out how this process works?
Well, it might be, for example, to manage a facility.
Okay.
And it would be a very specific kind of facility that we would like to maintain, or it might be to sequence a genome.
Right. Okay.
And that's a very, very well-delineated task. We're going to give you so-and-so much money, and you're going to come back with the full sequence of this particular organism's genome and annotations and so forth.
Okay. How important to the NIH's overall mission, and say if you want a little bit about that, about how big it is, how much money NIH spends, and what it's tasked to do overall, and the Center for Bioinformatics and Computational Biology, where it fits in, and how important it is within the overall NIH mission, and whether that role is growing or not as
mm-hmm.
we move forward.
Well, so overall, the NIH budget, I don't remember the exact number, but it's a bit under $30 billion a year. And out of that $30 billion, approximately 15% is spent on intramural research, it's spent on research that's done here on the campus or in one of the campuses of the NIH. About 85% goes to extramural research.
Okay. So you're more an administrator of other people's money than you are a research organization yourself by a pretty heavy ratio.
That's right. That's right. So, so we send the.
Is there something that generally qualifies something for in-house research? Is it the most important stuff, the hardest stuff, or the easiest stuff, or what criteria determines what NIH does in-house and what it ships out?
In all honesty, I think that has as much to do with history,
right,
as well as anything else. There were certain labs that were developed internally at the NIH and lines of work that have historically been continued.
Right.
But
does that mean most of the newer stuff is sent out?
No. I mean, much of the stuff that's done in-house is cutting edge, and you know, our internal researchers compete for Nobel Prizes just as well as the extramural researchers that we support. There is not a clear reason that's not rooted in history for why some things are supported intramurally,
okay,
and other things are supported.
It's ones that essentially fit in with the ones that the follow-ons to the stuff that's been going on there for a while.
Right.
A lot of the things that.
Okay. Right.
All right. Tell us a little bit about what is bioinformatics and what is computational biology. Are they the same things?
Well, bioinformatics is often used to mean what you do with a computer that's really based on information.
Okay.
On the information such as the sequences of genes, of the structures of proteins, the expression patterns of genes. Computational biology, sometimes the terms are used interchangeably, but often when people talk about computational biology, they mean not only informatics, but they also mean modeling of biological systems. And in many cases, that kind of modeling is physics-based, in addition to being, or instead of being, information-based. So, for example, much of the computational modeling of biomolecules is really physics-based. But it's also partly information-based.
Okay.
Sometimes people use the term bioinformatics to include that as well. The usage of these two terms is, I think, it's very easy to see why people get confused about the usage, because in point of fact, the usage is not always consistent.
Okay, now in about two or three questions we're going to get to the Center for Quantitative Biology. How does the term quantitative biology fit into that? Is that the same thing as computational biology?
Well, quantitative biology could be theoretical as well as computational. Quantitative biology could be really based on, really includes precise measurements as well as computation. So computational biology would always be a part of quantitative biology, and all of computational biology, or most of computational biology, is quantitative, but there could be aspects of quantitative biology with respect to being able to make very, very precise measurements or extensive measurements, being concerned with the physical instrumentation by which you make very precise measurements that would really transcend computational biology.
On a level that may actually matter more, do your colleagues or yourself, do you consider yourselves bioinformaticists, computational biologists, quantitative biologists? Is there a is there a softball game between the quantitative biologists and the informaticists at any point? How's that working out?
When people ask me what I do,
yeah.
I say I'm a computational biologist.
All right. Okay.
And essentially that's because I do not, in my laboratory, which I commute back and forth to at the University of Illinois, in my laboratory we're not doing wet lab experiments. Although I do have close collaborations, I have grant support together with experimentalists. In fact, I do have one student who's doing experiments in another in a colleague's laboratory. But I call myself a computational biologist.
Okay. Wet lab is another term of art, which seems pretty self-evident. What it is, it's
right.
where the chemicals are mixed and the cell cultures are cultivated, right?
Right.
How central then is all of this bioinformatics, computational biology, quantitative biology to the general biological research community and its work today? Did it used to be the tail? Is it now wagging the dog? How central to the enterprise is this now?
It used to be the tail. Now it's really embedded in all of cutting edge research. And instead of being the tail that's following on, what it really is now, in way too many cases, is it's the rate limiting step. It's the bottleneck.
It's both central and the bottleneck?
and really these are two sides of the same coin.
Right.
Because if the computational modeling was just an add-on,
right,
then it really wasn't getting in the way of anything else.
Right.
But if the computation is integral to doing and interpreting the experiments, then all of the defects in the computation, the fact that it may not be efficient or it may not be easy to use, or the programs may not be robust, they're always crashing, or they don't interoperate well with other programs that are related, all of those deficiencies now become rate-limiting steps.
So presumably that's part of or most of your job there now is to solve that problem?
That's the whole deal.
How did the physicists do with this? When they were getting all that information from the bubble chambers and the accelerators and so on, were they able to, did they have a similar problem at a certain point, and did they resolve it, and is that any model for the biological research community?
Well, they resolved it, or they are resolving it, because actually they didn't completely resolve it. So, for example, the cosmologists, who are really information-based in a way that's similar to the biologists, they're working very hard on improving their information systems because, that's a rate-limiting step for them. As it is for us, but basically the first way that the first way that people solve this is they have some clever graduate student or postdoc or somebody write programs that are specially tuned to the work of that laboratory.
Right.
And then if they're especially communitarian, they may work these programs up into a form that can be used by a number of laboratories. But it's still not professional software. It's still being treated, and I think this is really the issue, even as computation has become central to the practice and the progress of modern biological research, in many ways it's still treated like an add-on.
And in fact, the if you sort of compare Hubble, for one example, with various gene observation techniques, you've got a vast amount of data that's being collected, and then in order to know what it means and what you could do next, you need to do computations on it.
You need to do computations on it, and you also really want to make this resource available to the entire community.
So how is the effort to do that going?
I think things are getting better. I think we have, I think biology software is getting better. And I think we're at a stage where biology software is, by professional engineering standards, I mean, we're at a funny stage. We're at a stage where computation is contributing strongly to all of the advances that we're making. And it's also, and we're also at a stage where, since the software by professional software engineering standards is relatively primitive, we're at a stage where we can improve things fairly fast. And we are, in fact, doing that.
Presumably efforts are being made to bring in people who know next to nothing about biology, but almost everything about software engineering, to help you figure out how to make the programs work better.
Well, and so this is really what the National Centers for Biomedical Computing were explicitly designed to do.
Okay.
And this is what they will do. They will provide the central focusing points and a lot of the drive for making biomedical computing software better around the nation.
Okay, good. What's a center for excellence? What are the NIH centers of excellence? What's the function of
it? In complex biological systems, yeah. So these are really, I think the other phrase that captures what these centers do is systems biology.
Okay.
Which is integrating high throughput data with experiment to draw inferences about how biological systems work.
Right.
How they're organized, what's both the mechanics of the function and the overall organization theme of the organization of the system.
So those centers of excellence are dedicated to the proposition that they're going to elucidate those mechanisms.
Yeah.
Okay. How many of these centers of excellence are there?
There are.
Approximately.
There are now five.
Including the new one at Princeton.
Including the new one at Princeton.
Okay.
There were previously four.
And as I was asking before, do they all focus on the same thing, or are they sort of instructed what to focus on by NIH? Or
what's
the division of labor on that?
No, they tell us, they submit applications where they tell us what they intend to focus on.
Right.
And then we pick and choose.
Okay.
And we pick and choose largely based on the excellence of the science. And I should say, when I say we pick and choose, I mean the real picking and choosing is done by a panel of their peers.
Right.
I mean, we our Center for Scientific Reviews assembles a panel of scientific peers of the applicant, and they make very detailed judgments about among the competing applications.
Okay.
About which one is the most, which one or which ones are the most meritorious.
This is a little, actually, it's a lot too big to go into in any detail here. But just say one or two things, if you want to, about the general structure of what seems to be this huge machine for the production of science that you're near the center of, and this system of peer review and of education and of allocation of funds and so on is. Is there much sort of self-analysis of how the system works in terms of the product it turns out and the way it functions, or are people pretty satisfied that it's the most powerful tool for the discovery of knowledge that mankind has ever put together, and it should just be allowed to keep going the way it is?
Well, it should be allowed to keep going, but it should keep evolving.
Right. And are there mechanisms sort of to ensure and to make conscious the process by which it evolves?
One of the things that we do a lot of, I said that, you know, our costs are about 3.5% of the entire extramural research dollar. And one of the ways that we spend that 3.5 cents is that we repeatedly bring in panels of practicing scientists for a day or a couple of days at a time to do focused discussions with us about particular program issues and to give us advice on how we ought to structure our programs. We also, each of the institutes and centers, and so we do these kinds of things on an ad hoc basis where we'll ask a panel to come and meet with us and advise us on what we ought to do about systems biology or what should we do about computational biology, what should we do about nutrition and any number of what should we do about structural biology, any number of particular, and these are very general topics. These would be typical topics for the Institute of General Medical Sciences, but for example, the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute will convene similar panels, but those will be focused on particular areas within the mission of their institute. So we're doing this for particular topics all the time, and in addition to that, each of the institutes has an external advisory council with whom we meet three times a year. We have two-day meetings with them three times a year, and they review what we're doing, they review what we're funding, they review how we're making those funding decisions and what kinds of initiatives we're creating, and they have real power. They actually have to, they can't tell us what to do, but they can tell us things not to do. So we actually don't don't fund grants and we don't put forth initiatives unless our advisory council gives us permission to do that. We present all of those. So we actually are continually being advised and adapting to and responding to the advice of the sort of a cross-section of practicing research scientists around the country.
Okay, so it sounds like a complex biological system to me.
It is, yes. Well, it embodies adaptive feedback.
Right, exactly.
Which is really key to how biological systems evolve and function and survive thrive.
It's encouraging that you're paying attention to your own findings in that way. Where did the idea for a new center of excellence to focus on computational biology emerge?
It emerged from an external committee that gathered in 1999, and the then director of NIH, Harold Varmus, had asked this committee to, it had become clear by that point that computation was important in biology, and it also had become clear to the NIH that that it didn't really have an infrastructure for making decisions about how to do programs in computational biology or how to do programmatic decisions about computational biology. So this external committee was formed and asked to make just tell us what they thought we should do. And I say they and we. I wasn't at NIH at that time.
Right.
But this was this actually by coincidence. David Botstein was one of the co-chairs of that committee. The other co-chair was Larry Smarr, who at that time was director of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications.
Right, he's at University of San Diego or something, or Irvine.
California, San Diego now. Yeah.
Right. All right. So you weren't involved really in the creation of the center from that.
So there was a recommendation to create this Trans-NIH Biomedical Information Science and Technology Initiative, and the number one programmatic recommendation was to create the National Centers for Biomedical Computing. So three things were done. the Information Science and Technology Initiative was created, and it went through a couple of acting chairs. And Jim Cassatt was the acting chair just prior to my arriving.
Right.
And there was a funding program where a number of medium-sized or smaller computational biology centers were supported. And the judgment was that this was preliminary to creating the larger centers. Shortly after that time, Carl Varmus left and was replaced by, was replaced by Elias Zerhouni. And Dr. Zerhouni took a little while to review the recommendations, decided to move forward, and so in the summer of 1991, a search was launched.
I'm sorry,
I'm sorry, in the summer of 2001,
right.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
A search was launched for a permanent chair of the Information Science and Technology Initiative and a permanent director for the Center for Bioinformatics and Computational Biology. And the search took 2 years. I arrived in early in the summer in 2003, and my first task was to work with the panel, the external panel, and the program directors that were here to create a 10-year roadmap document for bioinformatics and computational biology and a funding recommendation, and that was acted on to create the National Centers for Biomedical Computing.
And where does this new Center of Excellence at Princeton fit into that?
The Center of Excellence at Princeton is a sort of smaller and more specialized version of the National Centers for Biomedical Computing. So in parallel with all of this, in parallel with everything that was happening across NIH, the Institute of General Medical Sciences was launching a couple of large project initiatives that really dealt with some of these issues. One was the Centers of Excellence in Complex Systems, which is where the program that's funding the Center for Quantitative Biology, and the other was the GLUE grants.
GLUE?
GLUE.
Is that an acronym?
GLUE. No, it's a real word.
Oh, glue, like something that sticks in adhesive?
Like something that sticks together.
Oh, okay.
And the idea of these was that these would be multi-institutional coalitions. And so by drawing from multiple institutions, you would get a pool of expertise that would enable you to really move forward on the various kind, in a more general way, on the various kinds of things that you have to do in systems biology. So the biggest and the first one of the GLUE grants was the Cell Signaling Alliance.
Right.
And then there are several of those have been funded. So NIGMS has been doing some small, or not, I mean not small, a few million dollars a year enterprises in systems biology for a few years. The difference between those and the National Center for Biomedical Computing, the National Centers for Biomedical Computing that are just newly being funded are explicitly designed to be infrastructure building projects. They do scientific exploration, they do research, but the primary mission is building infrastructure. The primary mission is building software that everybody can use, and the research that they do is really for the purposes of being a test bed for the software development.
Okay, so the product of all that will be software that will be usable by across institutions,
right,
to do more research.
Right.
Okay. Who decided where to put the Center for Excellence at Princeton?
This was a peer review decision. So the center, our Center for Scientific Review, again, assembled a peer panel, and the Botstein proposal was the one that came out.
Okay. And who decided to make Dr. Botstein the head of it?
That's his initiative. That process is very entrepreneurial.
So essentially, he made the proposal for putting the Center of Excellence there with him in Princeton.
Right.
And that was accepted.
Right. And this was competing with proposals from other proposals from all over the country.
Oh, okay. And is there a timetable for the establishment of the center? Is it in business now? Is it being set up? How's that working?
I think that the funding will start on October 1st.
Okay, and how much funding? What's its budget to start with?
It's approximately $3 million a year.
Okay, and is that center expected to exist in perpetuity or only for a limited time? Or?
Oh, it's a 5-year grant.
5-year grant, okay.
And this is not expected to continue in perpetuity.
All right.
And it's not expected to die either. It's expected to do very good work and then to give birth to other projects.
All right. The biological metaphors seem to exist under the surface of almost any of these things we're talking about. It's very interesting. Say a little bit, if you would, about Dr. Botstein. I interviewed him last week, and what his role has been in computational biology or in genetic research generally, and why it turned out that he got the nod here.
I think it's I guess it's a cliche, but it's the vision thing.
Okay.
He just has such a good sense of how the pieces fit together, not only the pieces with respect to research, but how research and education fit together.
Right. I wanted to talk about that. He talked about that. What's the mission for education at the Center for Excellence in Princeton?
Essentially, it's to train people in fully and comprehensively in this new approach to biology, which is quantitative and which does look at biological systems as being more than the sum of their parts.
Thomas Kuhn wrote a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. He said that new paradigms have to wait for one generation to fade away so the new generation can use it. Is the paradigm of non-computational biology sort of fall into that category, and the idea here is to accelerate the process by which a new generation is raised up that didn't know that biology and computation were separate fields?
Yes, with a qualification.
Okay.
Because we certainly have seen... I read Kuhn's book a long time ago.
Right, you read it a long time ago.
I mean, I read it 30 years ago.
Right.
But I do remember very clearly that one of the themes that came through was that in order for things to change, you sort of had to wait for the older scientists to move out of the way or
right.
retire.
Right.
But I have seen a lot of people in the last, decade or so do a lot of growing in the course of their careers.
Right.
So in fact,
people have become more adaptable than they were in Galileo's time, for example.
I mean, and this is actually really different from the process that that Kuhn described.
Right.
So I think that and this is interesting. So the computational revolution is really, I mean, I think Kuhn, as far as I could tell, I'm not a historian of science, but as far as I could tell, he accurately described scientific revolutions up to that time.
Right.
But the computational revolution is really different from what he described, in the sense that many, many people who didn't use computation early in their careers began to use it and now incorporate it into their work.
In fact, that's possible because computation is really complementary rather than contradictory of the biological paradigm, it seems. You don't need to throw out the cells with the computer cards or whatever.
Yeah, it's really remarkable because I mean you've just really put your finger on it. It doesn't directly compete, and yet it does lead you to change your perspective.
Right.
And in particular, it leads you to change your perspective on complexity. It leads you to a view that biological systems are not parts that fit together in the sense that every part does one thing, so that a biological entity is a machine.
Right.
But for example, there are many enzymes we now know that have multiple functions and are involved in multiple pathways for signaling, for metabolism. So I think we didn't appreciate this until we were able to do to do computation combined with high throughput experimentation.
And in fact, what you get with the computer's ability to manage huge databases and huge numbers of variables and their interaction is that instead of saying, you know, here's a space that we don't know what's going on in it, you needn't say that it's random. You can say that it's determined or regular, and you can understand the processes by which it is through the power of the computational tools.
It is determined and it is regular, but gosh, the rules are complicated.
Right.
I mean, we now know, for example, that genes don't evolve just by the accumulation of single mutations, but they sometimes evolve by splicing themselves together.
Right.
Or by just having, you know, big sections change places. And we know that there are interlocking things such that you may have a particular kind of regulatory site combined with a couple of different kinds of active site, or a particular active site combined with a couple of different kinds of regulatory site, so that genes are not, you know, genes are not indivisible units. The only indivisible units, I guess, are the nucleotides. Everything else
it's all up for grabs.
It's up for grabs. Yet there are rules. But the thing that makes it different from physics is that while you can say that there are rules that explain almost everything that happens, there are hardly any rules that you can't find exceptions for.
Right.
So while you say, for example, that information flows from DNA through RNA to the protein, yet sometimes it goes backwards. So Jim Watson called the central dogma isn't universally true, but it's mostly true.
These exceptions to rules sound a little bit like Ptolemaic astronomy, and I guess the question there is that was eventually resolved with a new paradigm.
Right.
Are these exceptions to rules going to reach a point where the rules are so complex that there are no exceptions to them anymore? In other words, will the rule discovery process be precise enough to eventually account for what now appear to be anomalies?
I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is because it's not a stationary target. It keeps evolving. So.
But according to the same rules, doesn't it?
Yeah. But there's, you know, there are rules and there are meta rules.
Right.
Sure. I suppose that might be.
Okay.
I guess I'm just really not. I'm really not wise enough to see clearly that, you know, the resolution of that, but my gut feeling, and now I'm trying to figure out why I have this gut feeling.
Right.
But my gut feeling is that we're not going to come to some completion on this. That it's not going to be like the, you know, the resolution of, for example, really complex rules about planetary orbits that all get resolved by theory of gravitation.
Right.
I don't think it's going to be like that. And the reason I think it's not going to be like that is that what's really at the bottom is an incredible combinatorics, an incredible number of different possible ways for things to get done, and a number of possible ways for things to get done that are so numerous that the number of ways that they actually get done is really tiny compared to all of the possible ways.
So you're going to say sort of that the infinitude of the mathematics underlying everything is
right.
So expansive that there's no way to reach an end to it?
Yeah. So back about the time that Kuhn wrote the book called On the Structure of Scientific Revolutions, there was another book that, to me, intellectually, was just about as important, but never really became so famous. A man named Walter Elsasser wrote a book called Atom and Organism.
Right.
And Elsasser, that he said that the essential difference between physics and biology was that if you were looking at physics, if you were looking at simple, relatively simple physical systems, that the number of samples of the system you had was large compared to the number of possible ways that the system could behave. So that you could get statistics that were good enough to make absolute rules.
Right.
But if you're looking at living systems, the number of systems that you have, the number of samples that you have, is tiny compared to the number of different ways that the system could possibly behave. So that you can never run through all the possibilities.
Well, another way of connecting the physics and biology is, I was going to first say that the physicists seem to be continuing to go deeper and deeper into matter or matter energy and come up with more esoteric theories each decade.
Right.
And without any end in sight, essentially. But at a certain point, some of that advanced physics is going to be considered in the biological realm to figure out, you know, whether the unpredictability, if it still remains that way in biological systems, is based on quantum generated unpredictability in the underlying physics system, and if that's the case, it biology will have to wait until the physicists, who I assume by now are pretty much computational physicists, as much as the biologists are computational biologists. To resolve some of the issues about the behavior of the nucleotides, which you were saying are the unmoved movers in the whole process, if they're made up of strings, what's that going to mean for the behavior of the biological system?
You know, I wrote a paper on this topic in 1972 that was trying to relate uncertainty in the predictability of biological systems to quantum mechanical uncertainty.
Right.
And essentially it was sort of the story that I just said, that there is that yeah, you can kind of relate them in a formal sense, and they really come from the same a parallel measurement theory, which is sort of the Bohr interpretation of quantum mechanics, that the uncertainty principle was intimately related to the possibilities of doing measurements.
And, right.
And that was really what Elsasser was trying to say, and I wrote this paper to try to say it more explicitly.
It's almost like you're going to have Schrodinger's cat down there at the molecular level.
Yeah.
For the nucleotides, you can't tell which way it's going to go until you open it up, and then you've either killed it or not. So
absolutely,
you can't know. All right, let's leave that particular Zen koan for another day.
Yeah, because I actually am going to have to leave in about approximately 15 minutes.
Okay, well then let me try to wrap this up and move on to one or two other things I wanted to cover before we finish. To talk about Dr. Whitmarsh, who I'm hoping to talk to later this week,
right,
and what his role is in mediating between NIH and the center in Princeton.
Ah, so Dr. Whitmarsh will actually be directly the program director.
Right.
So he'll have direct oversight, and Dr. Botstein will make, you know, progress reports to him, and will, advise him about, make regular progress reports, advise him about particular developments at the center as that seems appropriate. And Dr. Whitmarsh will also be looking for, one of the things now with the establishment of the National Centers for Biomedical Computing is, as those really kick into gear, we are going to be looking for synergies between the national centers and other projects. So Dr. Whitmarsh also serves as the chair of the project team for the National Centers for Biomedical Computing. And in that capacity, he oversees the administration of those centers. And so he'll be very aware of developments that are complementary or synergistic in those efforts.
Okay, you're right. Now, the press release that got me started on this story listed three key biological questions that the Center in Princeton is going to work on: how body patterns are established during an organism's early development, how cells control their internal functions to communicate with each other, and how viruses interact with host cells. Why were those selected, or why are those the important issues that they're going to deal with at the CQB?
Well, the thing that is really the other aspect of that's really of interest with respect to the center, in addition to those topics, is the choice of the organisms.
Right.
That are, so you're looking at mice and rats and humans and Drosophila and viruses and bacteria.
Okay.
So these organisms and these organisms are really chosen to map onto these topics. Since you can compare humans with rodents with each other, it gives you a couple of degrees of fine structure in terms of what differences really, you know, what really makes the difference within mammals, within a particular class of mammals, what really makes the difference between mammals and a very different animal, an insect, and what makes the difference between eukaryotes, these multicellular organisms, and bacteria, and how do they all relate to viruses. So there are going to be certain patterns of signaling, and there'll be certain patterns of body pattern development that will be common. Well, there'll be patterns of signaling that will actually be common to all of these organisms, from bacteria to humans.
Right.
Then there'll be patterns that will be different and will be specific to particular ones. And so sorting out the similarities and the differences, and then, of course, among the multicellular organisms, there are going to be patterns of development that are similar and patterns of development that are really distinctively different.
So, in fact, there's a very economic distribution of questions being asked and subjects being examined that will give a maximum it's parsimonious to the amount of work will give pretty clear answers to some basic questions.
Yeah, and parsimonious is exactly the right word because, you know, the verb is parsing. It will it parses out the parsing out of the scientific questions and the organisms that are the subjects of the study is just very neatly done.
Right. Two words that have been starting to come up as I've been covering this story are proteomics and protein folding. Mm-hmm. What are those? Why are they so important, and how does computing make them easier to do?
So proteomics is really the next stage after genomics. That is, the gene of any organism, the genome of any organism, tells you all of the proteins that you could produce.
Right.
Proteomics tells you what proteins actually are produced under different circumstances. And that's equally important to know. So one of the interesting things, of course, is that in multicellular, and of course this, there actually is a relationship now to stem cell research.
Okay, which we're not going to talk about.
We
can talk about the relationship, though.
We could talk about the relationship. So at a certain point in development, in multicellular organisms, certain genes are turned off permanently.
Right.
And will never afterwards express themselves. And the importance of this mechanism is that it preserves the integrity of that cell type.
The turning off of the genes.
Right. So the embryonic cell, the cell in the very, very, very first stage embryo, the blastocyst, every cell has, you know, none of the genes have been turned off.
Right.
Permanently. So every gene is capable to be expressed.
That's what makes them pluripotential.
Which makes them, yeah, pluripotent, right. Which
right.
makes them have pluripotentiality, I
right.
guess.
Right, right.
So then the question, so proteomics is critical in following the pathway of development.
In fact, if the process by which the genes are turned off in the stem cells is reversible, then any cell could become a stem cell again, couldn't it, if that process was reversed?
If you could reverse that, that's absolutely true.
Right.
And of course, you can do sort of bizarre things like you can target particular genes and make legs grow out of a fruit fly's eyeball,
right?
And stuff like that. But
it's precisely because you don't want to have too many of some cells, or you don't want to. Or if they're still allowed, if they had their full complements of genes turned on and were reacting to the environment that they had at a certain point, they would do things that wouldn't be functional for the organism. But in a case where the organism has been damaged, either for external or internal forces, it might be good to turn them back on. And if you knew how to do that in the right way, and even maybe a little better than they were before, you could do a lot of interesting things.
Right.
Well, we're not going to talk about that too much here, but
okay.
Say just something about protein folding. And as I finally understood it, I think I had a minor epiphany about it yesterday. The genes give the information for creating the proteins, and the proteins then form in some kind of chain along the line of the DNA. But they need to be folded into a three-dimensional space in order to function as they're they're intended to as protein. Intentionality
right.
here, but in order to become the proteins, they need to be folded properly, and that involves all kinds of complicated possible arrangements, and that's where computation comes in as a way of understanding what the different possibilities are and which ones are finally realized. Is that why computing and protein folding are connected?
Absolutely. I mean, you've got combinatorial explosions at every level,
right.
And one of the places you have those that level is in the folding of the chain of amino acids into a protein.
The folding of the amino acids, right. Okay, well, I think we have an infinity of more things to talk about, but let's just talk about two other things in very briefly. There's a professor at Harvard named George Church, who was mm-hmm. the subject of a cover story in Harvard Magazine a few months ago, and he thinks it would be a great idea for everyone to have their individual genome calculated and available for doctors to help with drug interactions and all kinds of other diagnostic procedures. What do you think about that? Would it be a good idea for everyone to have their genome sequenced right now? And would that cost a lot per individual? Would it cost too much for the society? What's the trade-off? What are the trade-offs there?
At some point, I'm sure that would be a good idea. Whether it's the most cost-effective way to personalized diagnosis and personalized therapy, I'm not sure. For example, the National Cancer Institute supports projects that where people look not directly at the or not in solely at the genome, but will look at gene expression patterns in transformed cells and in normal cells.
Right.
And by the gene expression patterns, be able to diagnose the be able and so what you find is that and then you can challenge those you can take a cell culture, and it's a normal cell culture, challenge it with a carcinogen and look at the difference in the gene expression patterns between different lines that come from different people. So you'll find there that actually there's a wide variation in the expression pattern.
That these gene expression patterns are more cheaply and easily calculable for everyone than a whole gene sequence would be?
I think it's something you have to do on a case-by-case basis. So in some cases, expression patterns might be more directly useful for diagnosis and for personalizing therapy than for example, trying to derive that directly from the genome.
Okay.
I think these approaches are complementary to each
other. Right. Okay. But if you did have genomes for everyone in particular, then you cross-tabulated it with medical records, you ought to be able to start coming up with some very powerful correlations about genes and disease states, if in fact there is a connection, or whether it has to be mediated through the amino acids and the proteins and the expression of the genes, and maybe the finding would be that there isn't a correlation.
So one of the keys to what you're talking about, and one of the building blocks, would have to be the individual electronic health record for every patient.
Right. So that's just that may be as important and as difficult and as expensive to put together as sequencing the genes, which is a relatively straightforward if expensive process now.
So the president has the Department of Health and Human Services has hired just this year a person who reports directly to the secretary named David Brailer, I believe his name is.
Right.
I know his last name is Brailer.
Right.
Whose task is really to move forward the creation of electronic health records. So it might be an interesting person for you to talk to, because
so.
this is really you know, a key part of the whole thing. It's absolutely right that it would be useful to have everybody's genome. It would also be useful to have expression patterns from tissues, from cultured cells, from individuals, but there would be an enormous added value if you had complete electronic health records that you could correlate things with.
Presumably some of the stuff that you've already been doing in these new areas that are being opened up for computation, that's sort of a part of computational biomedical research.
Computation is embedded in every part of it. I mean, you can't do any of it without computation.
All right.
And without serious computation.
I want to thank you for talking to us about this today, and I'll let you go so you can get back to the computation and the administration that you've got to do to make all this happen. Don't hang up, but let me say goodbye for now, and thank you again for participating on Utopia Media Medical News Network today.
You're very welcome.